So, metabolic switching. So, the structure of the talk. What I'll do first, I'll show you that tell you what switching is, and so show you that it does occur. People have been seeing these things for a while. I'll show you some experiments that we've done to observe the switching. Then I'll talk about some mechanisms that can induce this kind of switching to occur. What are the networks? What are the properties of networks that can support switching? And if we have time at the end, some irresponsible speculation about why switching ought to occur, based on some kind of optimization argument, and so on. Okay, so this story goes back quite a long way to the beginnings of molecular biology as we know it, which is when Jacques Monod was playing with E. coli. And what he did was, as a grad student in the 40s, and he was growing E. coli in various kinds of sugars and just measuring their growth rates and tabulating all the different growth rates in the different media. And what he did was he put, at one point he put his bacteria in a mixture of glucose and lactose. And so usually what you would find is, as a function of time, if you measure the number of cells, then you get this exponential curve, which then eventually ends up saturating. When the medium is used up, they go into stationary phase. But in the meantime, there's this exponential growth phase. This is when you grow cells in a single sugar. But when he grew cells in glucose and lactose, he got this famous picture. Looks like this. And so this is what he calls deoxy, or two growth curves. He got an exponential growth phase, then a lag phase, and another exponential growth phase. And so he thought about this for a while, and the explanation he came up with was that these bacteria were first metabolizing the glucose that was in the medium, depleting that, and once that was done, they had to sort of synthesize the machinery. They needed to metabolize the lactose and start up again. And the reason this was quite a phenomenal idea at the time is because people just thought of cells as a fixed bag of proteins, right? And there was no concept of their being able to synthesize something new from some kind of information that they possessed but they didn't transcribe. So this was pretty fundamental, and this led to his lifetime of research with the lac operon.
Is this you're talking about?
Mono.
Oh, okay.
Well, he did all the work correctly, yeah. But this was the curve that started it all. Everything was, they did biochemistry right. Then, so the idea was somehow that the cell had a preference for glucose over lactose, and it was a little strange. So, the enzyme that E. coli needs to metabolize lactose is called beta galactosidase. Okay, and you can check to see whether this enzyme is transcribed in the presence of glucose, in the presence of lactose, in the presence of both. So let's make a little diagram of that. Glucose, lactose. So these are our inputs. So you can have neither of them present, just lactose present, just glucose present, or both. And you just make the measurement to see if this enzyme that's needed to metabolize lactose is synthesized. Well, first of all, if there's no lactose, it's not synthesized. Kind of makes sense. And if there is lactose, it is synthesized. However, if there is lactose, the glucose is also present, it's not synthesized. Yeah?
Can I bother you? It's my fault I was late, but I mean, I don't understand this. Just tell me quickly what's the difference between the two graphs. I mean, what are you graphing?
So this is the number, the experiment you do is you grow cells in a beaker containing one sugar, two sugars, or some such thing. So the usual curve you get when you grow cells from a single colony is an exponential growth followed by saturation. If you grow it in a mixture of glucose and lactose in particular, you get two exponential growth phases with this lag in the middle. And the explanation for the lag is that it's synthesizing beta-gal. And without beta-gal, it's not able to metabolize lactose, and cell division is not yet occurring.
So if I even grow a cell that has not seen, let's say, lactose before,
yeah,
was growing on two curves,
yeah,
and then any growth curve should have a lag phase at the beginning.
Oh, of course, yeah. Any growth curve has a lag phase at the beginning.
A lag phase at the beginning, but not initially exponential.
Yeah. All, but there's various reasons for this. There's all kinds of retooling that go on. Yeah. That's a good question. Not all pairs of sugars produce a lag phase.
Okay.
Not all pairs of sugars produce a lag phase. This is very important. So in certain cases, bacteria are actually able to metabolize both sugars at the same time. And there is no issue of preference or switching or any such thing, right? So then you can actually classify sugars based on whether the bacteria prefer this. You can make different classes of sugars, and some are mutually exclusive in the sense. Glucose trumps most, okay, but others do not. Good. So there's a couple of things about this. If I could rewrite this in a different way, you have glucose, you have, let's make this glucose, lactose, and beta-gal is only synthesized here, in the presence of lactose but the absence of glucose. Okay? This is the logic of the setup. So two things I'm going to tell you when we start is, first of all, how this preference gets set up, how glucose manages to trump lactose, and secondly, why I'm calling these zeros and ones, and not some kind of continuous variable. And there's some real sense in which there's an off state and an on state, and that's why we call it a switch. Good. So, this is some kind of phase diagram, right? You say what the parameters are, and you can say what the system is doing. But it gets better than that. Okay, so how glucose manages to trump lactose is, this is the picture straight from Albert's Molecular Biology of the Cell. This is one of these classic diagrams. This green thing is the lac promoter, and the promoter is the control element that decides whether this enzyme gets synthesized or not. Okay, it's controlled by two proteins. This red thing here is called the lac repressor, and the yellow thing is CRP, which is one of these global regulators. Both these proteins undergo allosteric changes in the presence of their small molecule activators. So the lac repressor binds lactose and gets deactivated, and then doesn't bind DNA anymore. CRP binds cyclic AMP and it gets activated. Okay? And the final part of the story is that in the presence of glucose, cyclic AMP drops, so CRP loses activation. Okay? So the simple story is more glucose, less CRP, more lactose, less repressor. Fine. And then you can figure out when transcription happens. If just the repressor is present, polymerase cannot transcribe. However, if the repressor is not present, but CRP is not present either, the gene is not efficiently transcribed. It needs the activator. So this is the only situation. In the presence of CRP, but the absence of the repressor, the transcription occurs. And you just figure out that that's the same thing as saying in the presence of lactose, but the absence of glucose, the gene is transcribed. And
what do you need cyclic AMP?
Cyclic AMP you need, to do it sufficiently. But that's affected by the CRP. Cyclic AMP comes from somewhere else. I might get to that in the second part of the talk. What exactly? So this black box that I've done, this is glucose goes up and cyclic AMP goes down, happens elsewhere, but it happens very robustly. So I'll remind me and ask me again. I'll get to that. Okay, good. So this is how the logic of it happens. Secondly, why these zeros and ones are there is that this is the other old story. This is from 57. People have known this. There's a positive feedback loop in lactose regulation. So this again is the lac promoter that was green last time, it's black this time. The lac operon has three genes co-transcribed. Lac Z, which codes for beta gal, lac Y, which codes for a protein called the permease, and lac A, which people still don't know what it is good for. But you can take it out and so far no measurable changes in what the cell does. Okay, lac Z again is needed to metabolize lactose. Lac Y codes for the permease. This is a pump. It's a proton-driven pump driven by membrane potential. It actively transports lactose from outside the cell to inside. Once lactose gets into the cell, and this is what I told you before, that lactose binds to the repressor, deactivates it, stimulates further expression from the operon, creates more permease, and you get driven up to a high state. So this is the simple positive feedback loop. So you can imagine that if there was no permease to begin with, lactose would never be able to get in, and so you never move to any state, even if there were lactose outside the cell. And if you start off with a lot of permease, you get stuck in that state because you keep drawing in lactose from outside the cell. And okay, so what happens is lactose comes into the cell, it gets converted, let me draw this here. Lactose external moves in by the permease to lactose internal, which gets converted by beta-gal to allolactose. It's a sugar called allolactose. Two molecules of allolactose bind, one each to each monomer of this repressor dimer, and causes the repressor to stop binding DNA. Changes conformation. Very well studied. This is one of these first stories. All these are first stories. This is the first story of allosteric changes. This is the first story of transcription. Yeah, there's a lot of good stuff in here, which I'm not going into. But if you read, there's a book called The Lac Operon, which the whole story is in there. Over the last 5 decades, people have put this together. One of the first genes to be sequenced and so on. Good, but you can make this formal. This whole issue of positive feedback. And it goes by the following. Why is the concentration of lac permease? Okay, this will be the dynamical variable. And two parts to the rate equation for lac permease. One is that it is degraded or diluted, or there's some means by which it's removed in a first order reaction. When I say diluted, it's because the cell is growing, and so if you stop synthesizing any protein, the concentration of the protein is going to drop. So this is actual concentration. This term here, which I don't want to derive, but it's simple enough to see what's going on. At low values of Y, at low values of the lac permease, no lactose is being pulled into the cell, so the gene is not being transcribed. At high values, it's being transcribed as efficiently as possible. So this is a curve that had one of these usual sigmoids. It's one of those usual stories. The degradation is just linear in Y because it's being degraded in the first order reaction. The generation, however, the more Y you have, the more lactose you pull into the cell, and the more you create. So the creation rate goes up. Why we have the sigmoid curve, which comes because of the square term, is because it takes two molecules of allolactose to bind the repressor and deactivate it. So two molecules gives you the square. If it had been a single molecule, it would have been just a single stable state. But I've written it like this because you can always almost whatever your model is of how lactose comes into the cell, how the permease affects it, and so on. This is sort of the minimal model that's needed to account for the sigmoid, the saturation. And these parameters, so far, are just, they have nothing associated with them. I just parameterized the equation in this way. A little while later, I'll show you how these relate to actual concentrations, actual things that I can vary in the experiment. Okay. But you can actually derive them from the known biochemistry underneath, where C is sort of CRP, L is lactose concentration, R is repressor concentration. You can actually derive these. But just take this as what we're looking at. So we have this dynamical equation, which can lead to two stable states and one unstable state, which is, again, if you plot the net creation rate, which is this line minus this line, you get two stable states and one unstable state, possibly. Or you can think of it as a system in a double well potential, if you want. And the point here is that it's possible to have a low permease state and a high permease state, both stable. Good. But if you vary these parameters, which are functions of concentrations outside and repressor concentration, all kinds of numbers associated with the cell, you don't necessarily have to have two stable states. So these are my general parameters, which I haven't given names to yet, and you don't know what they mean. But the point is that as you vary these parameters, you get all kinds of possible diagrams. And in some cases, you get two stable states. In some cases, you just get one. And the important thing is that here, look, if you're on the left, that means you're in a low permease state. If you're further to the right, on this axis, it means you're in a high permeable state. You can go from a low to high state continuously, meaning the state always exists, it just goes to higher and higher permeable concentrations, or discontinuously. You have a low state, and in a discontinuous fashion, there's a high state that comes into being, becomes more stable, and then takes over as the only state the cell has. And within this space of parameters, there's a region where things are bistable, and there's a region where things are monostable. And you can go from low to high either continuously or discontinuously. This is just generally expected for a system. This is generic. That's my only point. That's why I haven't said what these parameters are, because it almost doesn't matter. Almost doesn't matter. And by the way, so what does this diagram look like when there's a single stable state? It can look like this, meaning there's a high state. It can look like this, meaning there's a low state. Right? So, questions? So this red...
There are only two important parameters in this.
No, but I'm saying that... Good, but you could have more parameters, but you need at least two to get continuous, discontinuous transitions and the possibility of mono and bistability. At least two. And you can you probably always map other parameters into two important ones. Look, so anything else is going to be some function of this.
So if one would want to validate this model, one thing one can do, which I'm sure is very validated by now after 30 years.
You would think, but...
One would try, for instance, to produce hysteresis.
Yes.
Could be experimentally measured.
Yes, so I'm getting to the experiments.
Oh, great.
Good. Good question. And just to throw a little bit of confusion into this, it's a fact that all these systems are fairly noisy. Transcription from the gene, the degradation, control, all contain fluctuations over time. And what that means is that if a cell starts off in one stable state, you could, in some kind of random event, get pushed over the threshold and end up in the high state. So, but of course, there's some hysteresis and there's some time, characteristic time of tunneling. Point is this, if you start off with all your cells uninduced, and it's possible to set up the experiment so that at the beginning of the day, all your cells are turned off for permease by growing them in glucose, for example. Then you wait a while, some cells will make it over to that side, some will come back, and they'll keep on going like this. And eventually, the population of cells will equilibrate. And so at the end of the day, if you took your population of cells and made a histogram of the amount of permease in each cell over your entire population, you'd get something like this. And the mapping is very straightforward. Given this energy diagram, you get some distribution like this. This is not equilibrium stat mech, but it looks very much like it. This is completely non-equilibrium. Good. So if you actually made a measurement, what you would see is not sort of all cells in one state or the other, but you would get a diagram that was bimodal. You would get a histogram that was bimodal.
Sorry, what is beta here?
Unknown parameter that characterizes the amount of noise in the cell. It probably goes as a... Nothing to do with temperature. This goes as, these are number fluctuations. So the lower the number, the higher the effective temperature. With one of these square roots. In the, yeah.
So the expression levels, which are sort of in the middle between the two means, the two bimodal, that corresponds to what exactly?
These are cells transitioning here or there, but they spend less time in that state. So.
But here you're doing for each cell.
Oh, no, this is not each cell. This is a histogram of...
I understand, but I'm saying
if you take a cell that's sitting over there,
right.
Then very less... So if you plot it as a function of time for each cell, what the fluorescence was... Oh, sorry, no fluorescence. What the Y concentration was, then, you know, you might expect something like this. You might expect something like that. And so the fraction of cells that are actually... transitioning up or down are those things that are spending time in the middle there.
At any given time.
At any given time.
Right.
There's always some fraction that's doing this.
Times,
exactly. So I'll show you pictures of that as well. Okay. So I said fluorescence by accident, but that's really what we do. You can measure the amount of permease, or as a reporter for the amount of permease, you just take the LAC promoter, put in your favorite fluorescent reporter, and the more the fluorescence, the more the permease concentration. Right? So you can actually measure these things. So that's what we do. The reporter we had previously, I have some new things. We previously had this system on a plasmid. Okay. Plasmid is just a piece of DNA that sits inside a cell and replicates with the cell itself. On this plasmid, we had the native lac promoter with all the actually taken from the chromosome, going as far back as all the non-binding sites of regulatory proteins. Controlled by the lac promoter, we had GFP, green fluorescent protein. We also had put in a promoter that is purely CRP sensitive. The more CRP you have, the more expression you have from that promoter. That was for control reasons. It's also interesting to see, since it's CRP and lactose that control the operon, it's nice to see how both variables are changing. Okay. And that was a red reporter. I won't talk about this piece, except to show you one picture. For most of the talk, I'll just be showing you what the lac promoter and GFP are doing. And the protocol is the following. You take the cells containing this plasmid. You grow them in various concentrations of glucose and lactose, or combined glucose and lactose. And when you've reached some fixed time, and you set this beforehand, which defines a steady state of the population now, put the cells in the microscope, take pictures of them. You can actually see the fluorescence. The fluorescence is just a signal for the expression level at the lac promoter. Take a picture of 1,000 cells or more, make a histogram, that's what you get. That's a real histogram of real fluorescence. Oh, yeah. So GFP has a, our GFP has a lifetime of 24 hours. So it's, we're averaging over, yeah. So what we're averaging over actually is GFP doesn't degrade, but it dilutes. So every time the cell divides, the concentration falls over too. But you're right, and that's a constraint, and you cannot follow fast events. And we're fixing this, but I don't have that data yet. But I'll talk about that.
Why does it dilute? I mean, the plasmids aren't carried on.
The plasmids are carried on, but suppose you just stop expression, then the GFP concentration will decay exponentially, just because the total cell volume is growing exponentially.
Oh, good.
In steady state, suppose we had no issue of bistability or whatever, you just had creation and decay. In steady state, you put a constant creation rate and then cells divide and you'll have a constant concentration. That's true. But if you stop transcription, then your concentration will decay.
Okay.
So there is an effective decay, although it doesn't actually get cleaved or anything like that.
Okay. So all cells are equally green?
No.
What bacteria? So how do you decide? How do you decide which one is who's what?
How do you decide who? Oh, so
you have to have some arbitrary grayscale value where you decide is expressed or not, and you have to have some cutoff.
I've just plotted the actual fluorescence there.
Well, that's just the fluorescence there. Okay.
Yeah, that's the actual fluorescence. It's actual fluorescence per unit area, so it's concentration. Okay. But the way to get around this time is to measure total fluorescence. But I'll get to that at the end. Ask me again. The red is not uniform, but I'll show you again. This red does interesting things on its own. Ah, no, all cells contain plasmid. You express the plasmid? It would be nice to put it in the chromosome. This is, yeah, that's true. But what you should do then is to put in something like a highly expressed ribosomal RNA promoter and then use that as a control for general cell happiness. And normalized by that, yeah. So you know, you really ought to do that. So, but for now, we were doing this. But very good. It is almost that, but not really, because the expression is changing. The expression is changing. So, I don't think it's truly that, because you don't know whether there are other things that come into play with two interesting promoters like this. You need a completely boring promoter.
Some other issues. Of which there can be many.
Yeah.
And in principle, you want to look not just one reference, but many.
Yeah.
We do have a reference.
We have one reference, but you'd like a.
It's not uniform. It's reference. But I think this is life.
Yeah.
Both references are not going to be equal. And that is precisely.
In fact, the reference that people have been advocating, this highly expressed ribosomal RNA promoters, those have growth rate dependence. And people, you know, and then you don't know why. So that's also a problem. And growth rate is a function of sugar concentration. So you're stuck anyway. So first experimental picture. Here's again, to recap, what we've done is every one of these squares corresponds to a certain concentration of lactose and glucose in the growth medium initially. You grow them for a certain amount of time, fixed amount of time, put them on the microscope, make a histogram of fluorescences, that's what this is, and do this for a whole variety of glucose and lactose concentrations. So here's a very coarse-grained picture, and immediately you see there are two levels of fluorescence. There's where everything is bunched up on the left, or everything's bunched up on the right, the transitions between. Because it's not surprising that the transitions are so sharp, they're not really. These are very large changes. Okay, so it's logarithmic. So this is that little 0, 1, 1, 0 logic diagram I had before. So lac operon is only expressed in the presence of lactose, but the absence of glucose. And we knew this. It's good. That's fine. This is just to check everything is making sense. Okay. But let's see what happens where the transitions happen. So this is the interesting region. And you'd like to make a more fine search through that region as to what the cells are doing. It doesn't just go immediately from low to high. Or maybe it does. Okay, you just have to go and check. So that's what we did. So these four corners are the four corners of the red box that I drawn in the previous picture. And we've zoomed in. Okay, now just to make things clear, I'm going to walk you through this. How is this going to work? Let's see. Okay, so on the left, I have the big diagram. All the concentrations are as marked, but I've removed the labels. The blue box highlights is reproduced on the right. So that's the same histogram again. Now this is for very low glucose and very low lactose, and everything is off. Now as you increase lactose, the fluorescence increases, right? Those points on the left are debris that are getting picked up by the microscope. Now, so again, as you increase lactose, the mean fluorescence increases. Now if you add glucose to the mix, but leave lactose high, what happens is you get another state of cells. Those come to dominate the population, and there you have your, at really high glucose, everything is off. No fluorescence. So this is your discontinuous transition, continuous. And this red region is really the region where things are bimodal. Now it's, you could ask how to decide whether it's bimodal or not. I just did this by eye, so you can always check and see. So again, to walk through this.
There's always some residue.
There's always some residue. Yeah, always. So that's what the lowest you can get is low lactose, high glucose, and that's still, the cells have an autofluorescence background. Yeah, and you can deconvolve, but there's no need to really. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is actually the data. These are completely off cells, and yet there's fluorescence. These don't look like the medium. Yeah. So, again, another point. How do you go from low to high? You can go completely continuously. You can sort of just walk along and increase fluorescence each small step. The peak just keeps shifting to the right, and eventually end up there. Or you can create a new peak and just exchange the states. One state becomes more stable than the other, and the population takes over in the more stable state. And there's this region of bimodality, and probably a critical point somewhere here if you care to go look. Okay, but this is interesting. So this is a diagram that has, so you have to check this against what your predictions are. Okay, so what would you expect from this? Okay, so going back to way back in the beginning, I had this picture of a lac promoter. And the variables of interest were CRP concentration, lac, which was a measure of glucose concentration, and lactose concentration. And based on these two things, I was able to calculate what these two general parameters were as a function of concentrations. Okay. Now, if you take the Albert's model completely seriously, then what you find is that both these parameters, of these two parameters, only one of them is a function of any concentration at all. And that one increases with lactose and decreases with glucose. So the point is that if this is true, then all you can do is to sample a single line in this phase space And if that's true, then there's no way to turn on in one way continuously and turn off in a different way discontinuously. Any such thing. You can only sample. If you see bimodality, you'll see it both going up and down. If you don't see it, you won't see it going up and down. So what that P on is the like probability that the promoter is going to be on given some kind of normalized concentration of CRP and repressor. Inside the red is the bistable. This is the transition, okay, between the two. How you get this expression is you take the Albert's model seriously, and you say that there's four states the promoter can be in: nothing bound, CRP bound, repressor bound, or both bound. Those are the four things in the bottom here. And the only state in which things are active is when CRP is bound, nothing else. That's the state on top. And you take this seriously, and you get this picture. However, it's known that CRP and repressor have overlapping, at least one or more overlapping binding sites on the promoter. They actually prevent each other's binding. So what you could try and do is remove the state you allowed before where CRP and repressor are both bound. So you do that. And then what you get is that it's no longer this special case of a line, but this diagram actually opens up. This is actually the generic state, where if you add lactose, you move in one direction. If you add glucose, you move in a different direction. And it is possible to sample a region of bimodality and a critical point to increase continuously and decrease discontinuously. So all I'm saying is that without getting completely bogged down in details, you're able to discriminate between different kinds of models by looking at the phase diagram, not just the mean fluorescence, but by actually looking at the distribution in the population. Very good. Is that all I have? Oh, good. So somebody had questions of timing, and I just wanted to give all the experimental results we had. So these are experiments in progress. Instead of waiting to some arbitrary steady state, you take the cells in a certain kind of concentration, and you just check them at various times and see what the population distribution looks like. Right? So this is a case where you expected, where I plotted previously as bimodal. That's a case that I plotted previously as unimodal, because I had picked a time to make the measurement. What you actually see, you start off with uninduced cells. As a function of time, two states develop, but eventually everything sort of becomes highly fluorescent. In that case as well. And the reason is that GFP is just getting, it's just accumulating. And so although these cells might be, in fact, transitioning between high and low states, the GFP is not getting diluted fast enough. So this is actually some sort of average over the history of ups and downs. Okay. But the way to fix this is straightforward. What you need to do is to put the cells on a slide, grow them for a certain amount of time, and just measure total fluorescence. Take the difference, t equals 0, t equals t1, and that will give you the total amount of GFP produced in the last 15 minutes. That is the transcription rate. You're still looking at the population, but this population consists of cells that are probably transitioning up and down, and they're not getting rid of their GFP.
So the more naive explanation would be
the steady state really is.
Cells is just outgrowing other type of cells.
Yeah, the cells have different growth rates. The cells have measurably different growth rates, and but we plotted the time scales. This peak decays with a certain time constant, and those are not consistent with the measured growth rates of cells in glucose and lactose. There's more of a, so this is slower than that. That difference is too slow.
This is faster
than that. Yeah. That difference is not fast enough to account. Oh, good. So we can look at single cells. So this is the only picture I have, but I have the green and the red, because we happen to take pictures of green and red. So what we have here, phase contrast, green fluorescence, red fluorescence, and these cells were grown overnight in succinate, which is yet another sugar. What happens when you grow them in succinate is lactose doesn't get induced, so you have no green. Also, the cells are unhappy, so they are red. CRP, I forgot to tell you, was an unhappiness signal.
Second question. Actually, which one is easier to see in reality? Is it red or green?
Oh, our red was very, we use this very bright, but so, look, the green is the favorite reporter of everybody because they know everything about it. So,
but it's not actually the brightest.
It's bright. So, They are comparable. They're comparable. Okay. So
for some reason I thought that red was weaker.
It is. They are comparable. And there's a
How careful do you have to be there to not fry yourself?
Fry yourself.
Because you know the illumination of the sun might have an impact on the cell development.
Yeah. You illuminate for as short a time as possible the fluorescence and you just wait, but you can't help it.
Well, you can always make a small experiment.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't seem to make a difference whether we take continuous pictures or whether we wait 15 minutes between pictures. Yeah. But so if we are doing something, we're doing it whether we do it wait long or wait short. The thing I'm most worried about is not the optical effects, but the fact that they're on a slide, we have to fix them. And so on. So those are the real difficulties. And there, okay, what we really see is there is a difference whether you grow them on a slide or the same concentrations in a liquid medium. So that's a problem. It's always a problem. But let me just take you through this movie. What happens is initially cells are mostly red and not green.
Your previous fluorescence histograms, these were not single cells?
They were single cells, but they were you put them on the slide and take a picture. And so you don't really need them to grow. We're not following single cells. We're just taking all of them at once. So, but to really do it right, you'd have to follow the single cells. So you need a slide setup that keeps them happy. And we have that now. So, but I don't have any data. Okay, so, but you can imagine. So you can see how this looks. So initially the cells are all red, and then they'll become more green and less red. Here they are, they're growing, and then the green becomes visible and the red becomes slightly lower. You can't really see it. So this is sort of the initial state. That's the final state after a certain amount of time. Let me stop this and do this. Okay, so if you make a scatter plot of the cells, finally, the cells are mostly green and very little red. Okay, but you see that here, you can try and see, that there's two groups of cells as well in this two-dimensional space. So the point is that the bimodality is not just along GFP, along lactose, right? But it's really a group effort. I mean, both these are both these systems are talking to each other. It's not completely default. So the line separating these two is a diagonal. It's not just a vertical, which you might have expected. And this is why I said the CRP is interesting. It's not just doing something boring. CRP is a signal indicating that the cells have enough food. And lactose is also food, so it feeds back on that. That's all I'm going to say about this, though, because I don't want to get into it. Just as a final construct, we took the things out of the plasmid, we put them in the chromosome. You get an order of magnitude loss in fluorescence, but the peaks become much sharper. This is the usual story, and I highly recommend anybody who wants to do this puts everything in the chromosome. Red is hard to see from the chromosome. Okay, so that's the point. Our red. There are other reds out there. We haven't tried them. But order of magnitude loss. This is log base 10. Okay, so what we had was we tried to use a very low copy plasmid because lact repressor, as it is, there's very few binding sites in the cell, and if you soak up all the repressor using some medium or high copy plasmid, then things are you perturb the system too much. So this was a plasmid called PSC-101 star, whose copy number is reported to be 7 to 10. But what they didn't tell me when I started was the star means that the actual PSC-101, the copy number, is 20 or higher. And star was a mutation that disrupted the origin of replication. And so the fluctuations are wild. And you can see that this is true. Okay. Only one copy. Only one copy. We put it in the lambda attachment site and checked that it was there. You could put multiple colors in the chromosome. We've done that. Good. What's the relationship between these two? So that ten times. Ten. This is log base 10. 10 times more intense. Okay, so how do you explain it? So
it's a 10 copy number plus.
Yeah.
So
Correct. It is 10 times. It's almost, it's within expectations, right, for the means anyway. The point is the variance.
So, okay, but then the transcription rate is not the same?
No. It's actually a little higher, right, because you have less repressor.
So the same order of magnitude?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I can go check this carefully, and I didn't, I just saw the beautiful pictures, and I just completely went to come up. But,
Anyway, so
there's many things changing. First of all, just the copy number of promoters is changing. But secondly, the reporter is getting soaked up. So you have less, repressor. You have effectively less repressor in the plasmid case. So you might expect even bigger shift in fluorescence. But look, so what's happening with the plasmids is that there's a background distribution of plasmids over which any kind of transcription noise is being superimposed. So then you expect the variance to go as the mean. And that's what you got here, Paris. Yeah, but I forget how many hundreds of base pairs. We were very liberal in how much of the promoter we put in. We took the chromosomal native lac promoter and we just put it inside.
A couple hundred days.
Correct. Far beyond any sort of known binding sets.
So you expect the variance to go to mean?
Well, because there's an external distribution of plasmids, and then on top, so every cell could have 1 or 10 plasmids, say. Okay, then if there's any kind of noise inside, you still get 1 or 10 of an output. So that's why things are scaled linearly with this. Okay, so this is the external.
I don't have much less background in this. Dialectal state, now transcript is.
Correct. The fully repressed state is dark. Fully repressed state is dark compared to. It looks like just the camera noise, whereas before it didn't. The fully repressed state here, there's some. No, it's not as good. It's not as good as the other. That's much better.
Because on the
home
chromosome, we have this.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, okay, I don't know. So those kinds of structures. I couldn't tell you. I can tell you afterwards. Go back and check. Okay, so this is just so now all our experiments are done in the chromosome. This is the end of lactose, the end of experiments. So this is to show you the switching does occur. And the next 15 minutes. But other things that happen. So lactose is taken up by its own special system, the lac operon. There are sort of older sugars. Lactose is a new sugar. E. coli didn't always know how to metabolize lactose, or at least its ancestors didn't. So some of the old sugars are glucose, and fructose, mannose. There's a list of them, 9 or 10 sugars. And these are called PTS sugars, phosphotransferase system sugars. And the lac permease, the pump, is driven by a proton gradient. That's where the energy comes for the active transport. PTS pumps, again the permeases, are driven by energy, biochemical energy from high energy phosphoryl donors. Okay, and I'll show you exactly how this happens. So there's a whole list of sugars that use this system for their uptake, and we wanted to see how the cell decides to, between these sugars, which one to eat, which one not to eat. This will be short, though. So if everybody remembers glycolysis, it looked like this. You had glucose, a lot of stuff happened, and then you ended up with this thing called PEP, which is phosphoenolpyruvate, which then becomes pyruvate. So this is just a phosphorylated version of this, which then goes into the Krebs cycle and oxidative respiration. This is completely non-oxidative. And what happened is the rule was for every input monosaccharide, you got 2 molecules of ATP coming out. Okay. However, the input monosaccharide needed to be phosphorylated, which used up 1 molecule of ATP. So in the net, you got 1 coming out. Very good. So the story we're going to start talk about now is how this thing gets here. Glucose external to the cell gets phosphorylated actually by this conversion reaction. So it's a little convoluted. That's right. One of the ATPs comes from below, one comes from above. Absolutely right. Absolutely right. So, don't draw the whole thing? Okay. It was fine. Okay, so just two molecules of PP which gets converted to ATP. Keep that in mind. So, how does the phosphoryl? Let me just draw it. It'll take a minute. Should have come in last night. Okay, look. We'll see how this goes. What I mean to say by this crazy diagram is that there's glucose outside the cell, but it's not phosphorylated. When it's taken into the cell, the energy for that transport comes from a donation of phosphate. Because glucose phosphate is not able to leave the cell anymore through the same permease machinery. Glucose phosphate enters glycolysis. Every molecule of glucose phosphate produces two molecules of PEP. Okay. Now, this PEP can do one of two things. It can decide to become pyruvate and donate an ATP, or it can decide to become pyruvate and donate its phosphate to the uptake of another molecule of glucose. And the net result from this is one gain in ATP. So what happens is you go through the cycle, you pull in one glucose, you get out an ATP, and you keep on going. This is self-sustaining. Okay, so the economics of it works out. This is the thing that was puzzling about this whole story was that how does the phosphate get from, it's sitting here on PEP. PEP is actually the phosphorylated version of pyruvate. How does the phosphoryl group get from here to the glucose? And it's a funny story that involves four different proteins or more. Okay. This biochemical donates its phosphoryl group to an enzyme called E1, which donates it to HPR, to E2A, E2BC, and then to glucose. This is E2BC. So this is a little strange. This is a bucket brigade that literally carries the phosphate over from PEP over to glucose. Even stranger is the following thing. These enzymes, E2s, are sugar specific. You have a different kind of E2 for glucose, fructose, mannose, sorbitol, mannitol, glucitol, galactitol, and so on. Okay. However, these pieces are general. The phosphoryl from HPR is donated to all the sugar specific E2s, glucose, mannose, fructose, all of them. So this is the general PTS, and that's called the sugar specific PTS. These are, it's them, the enzymes themselves. They have domains that do back, it's reversible phosphorylation, and they do.
It's the same catalytic site that does both ways?
No, there's a couple of phosphoryl sites, and there's a bit of a transfer going on, and, but.
Okay, so the kinases and phosphatase
on. Great. So you're asking if this is an energy dependent. Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, so these are actually reversible, although that last one is completely irreversible, effectively. Good. So the way to think about this is that you have some phosphate flux. PEP is the phosphate donor. It's driving phosphate through this pathway. Up to here, it's always the same. At this point, it branches. If you have many sugars in the medium, S1, right, the phosphoryl group can either be transferred to this enzyme's permease or to this enzyme's permease, and then it can pull in a molecule of the sugar. And then this bacterium is not wasting time phosphorylating all kinds of E2s. If the sugar is not present, there's no E2. That story is just like the lac operon. when the sugar gets into the cell, it has an allosteric effector, a repressor protein, which binds to its own promoter and turns on the transcription from its own E2s. Right, so these enzymes are positively regulated by the intracellular, their own intracellular sugars. And it's all specific. Right? So you have phosphoryl group donated here, brings in a sugar, increases the concentration of that enzyme. So you can see now that there's some antagonism between the different sugars, because they're all competing for the same phosphoryl groups in order for the energy to be taken up. Good. So what we did was made a little model of this. We included the biochemistry. Biochemistry happens fast. Things reach equilibrium. Transcription happens slowly. Okay, so let the transcription be your dynamical, let the transcription variables be your dynamical variables. So these concentrations of enzymes are the dynamical variables. Given a certain enzyme concentration, you can figure out what happens in this loop, equilibrate that, and then feed that back into your equations. Okay, so I'm not going into this. I just want to show you what the equation looks like. EI is the enzyme responsible for sugar I, for its uptake and metabolism, for that matter. One reason or another. Okay, should I? I'm not going to say where these come from, but ask me afterwards. I don't have time. But look, here's the result. The point is, this tau is the flux, is the total flux of phosphate running through the PTS. How does it come? It's just the sum of all the phosphate fluxes going to all the individual sugars. Phosphate flux to an individual sugar increases when the concentration of that sugar increases. This is the positive feedback I talked about at the enzymatic level. So if you have multiple sugars, sugar 2 is going to increase its own flux, increase the total flux, which comes back into this equation, and reduce the flux available to sugar 1. They all compete for flux, and this is the manner in which they do it. This is not parameterized or simplified. This is the actual result of biochemistry, plus we've normalized everything. Okay, so these are real equations. We didn't make it as a model, as sort of generic model of competition. We actually took the biochemical equations, saw what they did, they came out like this.
So I'd say there's a lot of work now on chemostatic competition.
I see. So the resources are limited, and each kind of it's where the resources are limited, and
right.
Yeah.
I mean, it looks very similar to all these papers.
I see. Okay, I'll ask you all about it. So there's some interesting stuff going on. There's this E squared term. E squared, if you want to know, it comes up because E2A and E2BC are two different proteins. So both of them get transcribed. This is similar to sort of squared terms in lactose. But let's not get into that. Just the pictures. You have a dynamical system. You fix the sugar concentrations outside the cell. Then you see what these equations do for two sugars. So for two sugars, your two variables are the enzyme for sugar 1, the enzyme for sugar 2. These blue lines are null lines along which each one of the equations goes to 0. And where the lines intersect are all the possible fixed points of the system. And you might expect that this system, because it has this square term, it has this sort of up and down, there are four possible kinds of fixed points. Okay, there's this low-low, high-high, high-low, low-high, and all the unstable ones separating them. Okay? So given an external sugar concentration, I can always write these, draw these curves, and figure out what the possible fixed points of the system are. If you have a whole bunch, then it goes combinatorially higher. But I only treated the two sugar case.
Oh, okay.
Okay? Only treated the two sugar case. And we do experiments for two sugars, too. So these are the four generic expected states. Now, I'm going to... So again, given a certain concentration of sugar 1 and sugar 2, this is what these curves look like. I'm just going to summarize this entire diagram in the next page, just so everybody's on the same. This entire diagram in the future will be summarized by saying low, 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 high, low, high, high. These are all the possible states. Yeah, okay, it's not much of a summary. These are all the possible states that are allowed for this sugar concentration. And I'm going to see what happens as you vary sugar concentration. So the previous graph, those axes were enzymes, but we've thrown all that out. And we've just summarized that by low, high, low, and all that. On this graph, the axes are sugar concentrations. These are the actual things that we can vary in an experiment. Sugar 1, sugar 2. Okay? but also a couple of parameters here. And as you vary the parameters, other things can happen. So you can vary sugar concentrations and parameters. So that's what I'm going to do now. These five graphs, or three of them actually, these three graphs are diagrams as I vary the parameters, but I'm showing you what happens over all sugar concentrations. I'm just going to walk you through the first one, and you'll see what happens with the rest. Okay, remember, if you had in the lac operon, you had one of these dynamical equations where there was just a low and a high state. Okay, suppose I had two independent sugars. Each one of them could have a low and a high state. They wouldn't talk to each other. Now, as I varied sugar 1 and sugar 2, you'd have a couple of these hysteretic transitions. For sugar 1, initially you'd be low, and then you could be low or high, and then you could be high. Let's say high-low. And for sugar 2, it's the same story. Maybe I should do it like this. For sugar 1, you can be low, high-low, or high. For sugar 2, you can be low, high-low, or high. When you put those two together, you get all the possible states. You can be low-low, high-low, high-high. I don't have much time, but if this is not... this is okay? But in this case, they're not talking to each other, so there's not much that can happen, okay? But yeah. So what'll happen is they'll sort of tend to oscillate near the unstable points, but they'll move to the stable ones. It's not a real limit cycle oscillator, and it's not a... Not for this, but, you know, anytime you have positive feedback, you can try and do that. Wait, striking. I'll give you striking. Wait. Yeah. No, high-low means that there are two states available. Yeah. Well, presumably it's gone to both of them in a population level, right? Like I showed before. High-low means there's two states available. But the other sugars is... Oh, so okay. You're right. I have to explain this notation a little bit more. I have these two letters. So when I say low... high. Okay, this is what sugar 1 is capable of. This is what sugar 2, or the enzyme 1 is capable of, enzyme 2 is capable of. That's why here sugar 1 is low, but here it can be low or high. Here it can be high. But sugar 2 is always low. You don't have enough of it. That's what these letters are meant to represent. This is all possible ones. When you look at the actual PTS diagrams, the ones that you obtain from these equations, here they are, for different values of parameters. For a certain value of parameters, you get something that looks very much like this. Okay, you get switching transitions from low to high. However, this high-high state is gone. There is no high-high state. That's because of this competition. Two sugars are not on at the same time. They're both pulling phosphate. But the amazing thing is, for no values of parameters, you get a high-high state. You can change the parameters, and this graph gets twisted into that graph. Just sort of tying a knot a little tighter, if you can see that. And then you tie the knot and it becomes critical and it sort of vanishes. And you get that. Okay, so, but in none of these cases do you have a high-high state. I'm going to spend 1 minute talking about that diagram. That diagram looks like this. For certain values of the parameters, what the bacteria will... So what is the value of a parameter? It says what the bacterium is. So it's sort of the genotype of the bacterium. Okay, you can change it by adding extra copies of a protein, for example. So for a certain genotype, what will the bacterium do when I put it in these sugars? In diagram 3, I'll do this. Over here is high-low. Over here is low-high. And over here is low-high slash... What that means is that in this quadrant, when you have a lot of this sugar and very little of this one, first enzyme is highly expressed, second enzyme is not expressed. In this quadrant, second enzyme is highly expressed, first one is not. But over here, you have the possibility of both states occurring. Okay, so if anybody likes these catastrophes, these catastrophe theory pictures, it, you know, it's one of these pictures where you have a sheet like this. Right, so this is sugar 1. This is sugar 2. Over here on this part of the sheet, you're in the high-low state. On this part of the sheet, you're in the low-high state. And in the middle, you have both of them. Okay, so that's what is going on. So this is actually meant to be like a folded piece of paper. And so you should take this as some kind of very badly drawn three-dimensional graph. And as you, you know, it's one of these, this is what it's meant to be drawing. So you have a low sheet and a high sheet, and then a critical point in the end when the two sheets vanish and you have just one. Okay, so this is not, okay, it's just a way to think about it. And if you went back to the first part of the talk, most of the population spends most of its time in the more stable state. Okay, so in a completely symmetric case, the states exchange stability right in the middle. So here, high-low is the most stable state, and here, low-high is the most stable state, as it happens. Okay, good. So, fine. Just to be complete, you can do this for all values of the parameters, and you can check what all the diagrams look like. The three diagrams that I showed were this one, this one, and this one. These parameters have actual physical, sort of chemical meaning. Nu is the basal transcription rate of all the enzymes concerned. The more nu you have, the less external sugar you need, and you can still have enzyme. Beta is the amount of phosphate available for the sugars. The more phosphate you have, the less competition there is. So if you have either too much basal transcription or too much supply, then absolutely nothing happens. There's no interesting behavior, there's no competition, nothing. So apart from the uninteresting case, for most of the parameter space, you get this behavior. And this is this for the two sugars, completely symmetric. Yeah. But in some sense, you've lost the symmetry because you're changing sugar concentrations anyway. So this samples all the, unless something funny happens. Yeah. The two sugars are equal,
right,
in parameters.
So we know there's ordering. So
you can actually, in the PTS sugars, there's some loss of ordering. There are sugars that are almost completely identical. So it's possible to explore this experimentally for a pair of fairly symmetric sugars.
So what
sorbitol and mannitol are my favorite two candidates.
So the other has to be...
Well, so you wouldn't want... Glucose is a bad idea. Okay, so glucose, in fact, is not even inducible by its own substrate. Glucose is a bad idea, but all the others are sort of on similar footing. So that's, first of all, chemically you have access to fairly symmetric.
You want glucose and everything else?
I don't know, actually. I don't know. Glucose, fructose, and then maybe everything else. Okay, so... mannitol? Where do you get mannitol from? I don't know. You buy it from Sigma. I have no idea. Good question. No, it's a good... I mean, why do these things have these capability to metabolize all these strange sugars? I have no idea. If people are willing to sit for another few minutes, I want to talk about why this is, makes sense. But otherwise, I've finished. So experimental work was done in Alexander Van Oudenaarden's lab, MIT. I'm a grad student there. Sebastian Sung, discuss all this a lot with him. And it's always good. Boris, we started the Sugar Project, and that's how all this experiment got started. And this was, I don't know, a year, 2 years ago now, I don't know. Ertuğrul, Han, and Juan are my collaborators, postdoc and graduate students doing the experiments and at MIT. So, but hold on a second. Okay, I'm done. Anybody who wants to hold on later can wait. Thanks. Very good. So, right. Why would you expect switching? Okay, so let's do some really bad economics modeling. The model is the following. It's not meant to be biochemically plausible. It's just meant to talk about resources and resource allocation. So you have a pair of sugars, sugar 1 and sugar 2. Then you have the machinery that's needed to metabolize these sugars, enzyme 1 and enzyme 2. Let's just talk about the two sugar case. What is the bacterium doing? Bacteria are sitting in a beaker with these two sugar concentrations. They're growing and dividing, and the growth rate is gamma, which is to say the number of bacteria goes as e to the gamma t. Right. So, if you have energy coming purely from these two sugars, then the rate at which the energy comes into the cell is presumably proportional to the sugar concentrations and the machinery that's needed to metabolize these sugars, and some proportionality constant for each of those. This is the rate of energy input into the cell. What the cell has to do to produce these enzymes, take enzyme 1 for example, you can have some equation . What I'm assuming here is the enzyme is decaying purely by dilution. And there's no other waste. We're not actually cleaving the enzyme or anything. Even if the enzyme is decaying purely by dilution, if you don't create the enzyme, its concentration will drop because the number of bacteria keeps on increasing. Okay, so if you want to sustain a bacterial population with a certain growth rate, you have to produce at least this much. Okay, so in steady state, these two will be equal. And that's how you figure out what the concentration of the enzyme is. The energy input really comes in making the enzyme, transcription, translation. And so the rate at which the cell loses energy is some proportionality constant times these rates, rate of creation. But if you plug in the steady state result, then this looks like well, this gamma is the same for both of them because it's the growth rate of the bacteria. So now, if the bacterium is shunting all its resources from the sugars back into making the machinery to pull in the sugars and making new bacteria, so that's the growth rate, and what you really want to do as a bacterium is you decide how much enzyme to create in order to maximize this growth rate. But the answer in this case, it's completely simplified, but the answer in this case is very straightforward. You need to produce only that enzyme that gives you more bang for the buck. It doesn't make any sense to produce the other one. Okay, so you need to produce the variables are maximizing order of what is one. So what you want to do is sort of argmax E1, E2, because those are the things the bacterium has control over, right? The growth rate. And that happens because it's completely linear, so it happens where this over this is higher than that over that. So that means you synthesize E1 if alpha 1, S1 over beta 1 is greater than alpha 2, S2 over beta 2, and the other way around. And so the picture S1, S2, here you synthesize E1, here you synthesize E2. This is what you might expect a switch for completely symmetric sugars. And again, I said it was irresponsible speculation, but it looks very much like that at a population level. So this bit I wouldn't take very seriously, but these are if you do more complicated flux balance models, where you actually take seriously what the enzyme concentrations are, what reaction fluxes are, and so on, you still get discontinuous changes, switches. So you need switches to maintain optimality. That's it.